Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus.
Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Welcome, Resolvers, to Season 4, Episode 21 of Resolved Mysteries. This is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to cases featured on the show, Unsolved Mysteries. I'm Allison.
I'm Eliza.
I'm Carlin.
And welcome to the show. We're so happy to have you. As most of you know, for every review that we receive, we donate a dollar to a different organization, and this month's organization is St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital, suggested by our patron, Beth H. If you want to leave us a review, we will donate a dollar and leave a nice review.
Don't leave a mean review.
And be nice. And don't be a dick bitch.
And be nice to us. If you'd like to suggest a nonprofit for us to donate to and also support us on Patreon, you're going to get access to ad-free episodes, two additional episodes a month, early access to listener short stacks, along with goodies in the mail. Go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast, and we're going to get right to it. So what are we covering in this episode?
Well, in part one, we have a wanted segment about Marie Lilienberg and Maria Valen.
Okay, and then the second segment of part one is a lost love segment about a man named Joe Soul.
And then in part two, which will be next week, I have an unexplained death of Gary Simmons.
And then I wrap it up with a fraud segment of Richard Cundia. All right, short and sweet. Let's get started.
Let's do it.
So this is a wanted segment. And it's about Marie Lilienberg and Maria Valen. So UM's order of events on this one is especially weird. It's normally weird because they like to hook you in with a little bit of the middle of the story and then go back to the beginning. So they're doing that, but they're also starting with an update. So we have the first events they're going to tell us about. September 26, 1991, a bizarre anonymous phone call came into the Swedish consulate in San Diego, California. The woman at the consulate answers the phone and the caller says, "It's about two hitchhikers, two Swedish girls." And Stack says the caller then described a double murder. He says, incredibly, a double murder that had taken place a full 8 years earlier, this was the first solid lead since 1983. So then we go back. In July of 1983, in Commerce, a suburb of L.A., a gas station attendant was taking out the trash behind the building. Sergeant Bruce Coral of the Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Department says he looked inside the dumpster and saw a couple of backpacks. Checking further, he found clothing, diaries, there were rolls of film, passports, wallets, many of the things you would expect tourists to have collected in a several-month tour of the United States. Stack says that the items in the dumpster belong to two Swedish nationals, Marie Lilienberg, 23, and Maria Valen, 25. So I'm going to reorder things just a little bit here to tell you what the women were doing in the United States. So Maria Valen was a skier and had a dream of skiing on the powder in the Colorado Rockies. She had saved up money and had also taken out a loan to help fund her trip, which her dad said she was very excited about. She had been taking pre-college courses in tourism and had also worked as a nurse's aide. She really loved sports, and her ultimate goal was to become a gym teacher. She loved little children, quote, "She loved little children and was always organizing training classes for them at the local tennis clubs," her father said. She was a very sensitive girl, always taking care of her friends when they needed support, and a very conscientious and moral person. So in November of 83, Maria was finally able to take her trip to Colorado. She flew to Vail and took a job as a maid and worked in several hotels in the area, and then would spend the rest of her days skiing. While working for the hotels, she met Marie Lilienberg, who was also from Sweden. Marie was a grade school teacher and was spending her winter in Colorado. Obviously, they have a lot in common and they become really fast friends.
Wow, I assumed they went to the United States together.
I know.
Yeah, me
it's
too.
It's so weird. Like,
and when Stack talks about them being maids, he calls them chambermaids.
That's why I almost said barmaid. I was trying to think of the wording that Stack was using. It was chambermaid.
Like, I thought that was from medieval times.
Seriously, I know. And, like, housekeeper is what I think it would be called today.
Yeah.
But.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, just totally weird. They're both from Sweden. They both, like, working with children. Like, they're on this trip to Colorado. Like,
they pretty much have the same name.
Yeah. They have so much in common. And they're, like, 2 years apart. In mid-July, the women decided to travel the U.S. together for a while before they went back to Sweden. So they were like, let's take a few months and just travel around. So they actually ended up going on a trip to Hawaii together.
Nice.
Yeah, they were just having a good time. So then they knew they were kind of like ending their trip and they were starting to run out of money. So they decided to just sightsee in California for a little while. And their plan was to fly from L.A. in New York. They were going to travel to Connecticut to visit another friend that they had there, fly back out of New York back home to Sweden.
Okay.
So they start their California adventure and their first stop was to see a friend of theirs in Redwood City, which I believe in the segment they say is Northern California, but it was in the Bay Area.
Oh.
So this city is the last place the girls are seen.
Okay.
Sergeant Coral says the women thought it was safe to hitchhike. He says both their Swedish and American friends had told them that hitchhiking wasn't safe, but he explains they kind of just thought they were good judges of character and that they'd be able to tell if somebody was dangerous. Yeah. Sergeant Coral also tells us that Maria carried a knife with her and felt she could defend herself if she needed to. John Norton from the Swedish consul at San Diego says, young Swedes come to the United States from a culture which is entirely homogenous and middle class. He explains there's only 8 million people in Sweden and it's more open and trusting there. Mm. He says they remained as trusting as if they were in Sweden.
Mm. Welcome to America, baby.
I know. So Marie was supposed to arrive home in Sweden on July 31st. There was a quote from her dad, like he knew down to the minute, like when she was supposed to arrive, like it's burned in his mind. But she did not arrive on her plane. So when Marie Lilienberg didn't show up on her flight, her father, Uwe, immediately was super worried because when he had last spoken to her on July 16th, she had told him they'd been hitchhiking around. Quote, I told her not to do it anymore, said Uwe. I had visited America before, and I know it is not like Sweden. It is dangerous to do that there. She did not respond at first, but 4 hours later, she called me back and said she did not want to worry me, so she would not hitchhike to Los Angeles. But of course, they did.
Yeah.
So, and like, I don't know, they're traveling the length of California and they're running out of money. I don't really know how else they could have traveled.
Yeah.
So that's definitely what they were doing. And I'm sure she just told him that to like ease his mind. I'm sure that was fully still how they planned on traveling.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't show up. Both of their dads fly to California with the hopes of getting media attention on the case. Once they were there, they also offered up a $5,000 reward for information on their daughter's disappearance. And they were like going on the news and stuff like that, trying to get information. Over the next few weeks, over 50 sightings of the women were called in, but none of them could be confirmed. In Redwood City, California, Uwe Lilienberg and Lars Valen spent several days talking to bus drivers and other people they thought may have seen the women. In August, they even went on San Francisco television to ask for help from the public in locating their daughters. August 18, 1983, in Santa Barbara County, California, in the Los Padres National Forest, two men were deer hunting and saw a skeletonized arm in the wilderness. Quote, probably a coyote pulled one of the arms off and drug it out into the open.
Ugh.
Checking further, they found other remains hidden under brush there. So I think they actually even found the two bodies like maybe a day apart or a couple days apart.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So the belief was that they were both under this brush where the one body was found and that animals had pulled one of the bodies out into the open. So they don't mention in UM, but the women were found nude.
Oh,
God.
And only jewelry was on their bodies.
Ugh.
So the cause of death was not revealed for quite a long time, I think, because the authorities were hoping to, you know, make sure there weren't any false confessions or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the autopsies did reveal that they had been stabbed to death and sexually assaulted.
Oh, God.
So they do say this on UM because it's 8 years later, but I think for quite a while that was not out there. I'm surprised they were even able to tell all this because the bodies were very badly decomposed and almost fully skeletonized. That.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking there must have been, like, stab markings on the bones because I don't know how they could have told that. It was believed that the women were most likely Marie and Maria, but because of the decomposition, even their fathers weren't able to identify them.
Oh, my gosh.
So when the fathers were able to see the jewelry found on the women, Uwe Lilienberg had no doubts it was his daughter, even though she was totally unrecognizable. She was wearing...
Why would they have them look at them? If they were that badly decomposed, wouldn't they know you can't tell? That's so traumatic.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know how it went down, if they were like, we want to see them or what it was.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh.
She was wearing a small gold medallion that was etched with the Madonna on one side and the Lourdes religious shrine on the other side. It was a family heirloom which had been given to Marie by her grandmother.
Hmm.
Detective Coral said, I remember having them look at the jewelry and seeing tears in their eyes.
Ugh. Oh, God.
Before he had even seen the jewelry, however, Uwe had felt his daughter was gone. Quote, I've had an empty feeling inside me the past week. I am so very, very close to my daughter. We always talked and played tennis, and I just knew something horrible had happened. So it would eventually be dental records that they obtained through the Swedish consulate that would finally, like, positively identify the women. So Stack reminds us that part of what was found in the dumpster by the gas attendant was travel diaries and a roll of film. So by using these things, they essentially, like, were able to go backwards on their trip, seeing where they had been, who they had been in contact with. Like, sometimes they were taking pictures of the drivers that were driving them.
Mm-hmm.
A truck driver from San Diego named Mark Hansen remembered the women well. He's interviewed on UM, and he says, a lot of truck drivers out there have daughters, and if they do see girls out hitchhiking, they try to take care of them. Mark says they had talked about how they shouldn't be hitchhiking. I, maybe being too much of a big brother and maybe a bit of a lecturer on the way up, his words don't really make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But he essentially says he was telling them it's not safe to be doing this.
Yeah. And I'm picking you up so that someone else is not who you don't want to pick you up. I had never thought about it that way, what he says, that some of them, it's nice.
Yeah. And he, like, explains to them, like, this isn't Europe. And it's not safe to do this in the United States, but he says they didn't seem terribly concerned and they felt they would be safe being together. So, and it's, you know, it's that thing of when you're young and you just think you're invincible and you're going to be fine.
Well, and I really resonate with, well, we would be able to tell if they were crazy
100%.
And unsafe.
Or even thinking, well, there's two of us, so we're safer.
Yeah.
That isn't true at all. If anything, it's worse because the person can use your
true friend.
This person is your friend against you to get you to do something so that the other person doesn't suffer.
That's true.
Yeah.
If anything, it makes it more psychologically fucked.
Yeah. That's so sad.
Because they'll use that against you, the love that you have for your friend.
Yep. So Hansen gave the women a ride from San Diego to Compton. And he's just such a sweetie. He had arranged for a driver that he knew to be the next one to take them somewhere.
So nice.
Love him. So that driver then took them to Oakland. So then after this is when the women are last seen leaving from where they stayed in Redwood City, July 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
So 4 weeks after this is when the bodies are found. In an article from 1983, after the women were found and identified shortly after their fathers had traveled back to Sweden, there was a quote from Uwe Lilienberg again, and he said, leaving her here for now is not so difficult. Making the phone call home to my wife was what was hard. Mm-hmm. I was so scared to do it. But in a way, it was a relief to at least know what happened to Marie.
Jesus.
For 8 years, the investigation into the murders went nowhere, and then this anonymous call comes into the Swedish consulate. John Norton says, he said that he knew a fellow whom he had seen on a regular basis who was from Canada who would come down every winter in his van to go through San Diego to Mexico. He said that on one occasion in 1983, the man had come through and had mentioned he had met two Swedish girls who tried to con him. The caller also described the van. He said he drove a white van with a green canoe and that this was very recognizable and that a number of people knew him. John Norton says he gave a description of the man. He said he was over 6 feet, a slight build, 175 pounds, thinning red hair, long pointed nose, protruding watery eyes.
Watery eyes?
I don't believe that the call was a hoax. My regret is that the caller was unwilling to identify himself. If he would step forward even now and call us again, even anonymously, to provide further information, it might be helpful. So Sergeant Coral was the one who called UM about the case, which is really interesting because we almost always see that it's a family member.
Yeah.
So he was like, you know, there's this new information that's reinvigorated this case that's kind of been sitting for 8 years. And like, now I think someone's going to come forward. And so he brought it to UM. So in the end of the UM segment, Sergeant Coral says it's not only frustrating that they haven't caught the killer responsible for the murders of Marie and Maria, it's that they may be responsible for other murders across the country as well.
Yeah.
So, and throughout this investigation, he was really of the belief that this was a serial killer.
Huh.
Norton says, the moral of the story is that hitchhiking is very dangerous, and for women especially, it can turn out to be this type of situation. And then the segment just abruptly ends. So there is a reason for that. They cut stuff out. In my research, what's interesting is that in the UM segment, they did not include one major piece of information from the anonymous caller, which was that, and this was originally in the segment, but was later edited out, the caller had given the name of the man that he called to describe. He said that the man's name was Lauren.
Oh.
Yes. So then there was also an update that ran for a few years and then was edited back out.
We know a Lauren.
We do know a Lauren.
Wait, which one is it? The one that...
We'll talk about it.
Okay.
The update at the time detailed how police had identified... So this is an update added in later that had said the police had identified Lauren as well as the anonymous person who called the consulate.
Oh.
The update also said that there was further evidence implicating Lauren in the murders. Then when FilmRise took over UM in 2010, they took the update out and edited out all mentions of Lauren's name.
Interesting.
Yeah. So much to Sergeant Coral's frustration, despite some 200 calls they received after the UM segment aired, no arrests were made as a result of the information they got from viewer tips.
No way.
Yeah, but they continued to work the case. In an article I read from 1999, I read that they continuously followed up on every single time there was a truck driver arrested on a murder charge involving hitchhiking women. And at this time, Detective Steve Roble said there had been several in the last few years with similarities to the murder of Marie and Maria. So, okay, so now we're going to go to our 2022 update. Unfortunately, the murders of Marie Lilienberg and Maria Valen are still unsolved.
No way.
Yes. However, there is a person that a lot of people believe could be the killer. So, the name Lauren, a lot of people think, was Lauren Herzog.
Yeah.
Lauren Herzog is one half of the Speed Freak killers. So we talked about the Speed Freak killers because they were widely believed for a while to be the ones that murdered Michaela Joy Gerecht.
Yes.
Who we covered in an earlier season. I don't know. Was that season one, two?
I don't remember. I think it was season two, episode 17.
Oh, my God. Allison, your memory for this shit is.
Yeah. So just to refresh your memory, if you don't remember... The Speed Freak, if you're not Allison and you don't have a photographic memory, the Speed Freak killers were Lauren Herzog and Wesley Shermantine. They were childhood friends who somehow became a disgusting serial killing duo. The Speed Freak killers got their name because they were constantly on meth. They had been convicted of three murders together and then each of them separately for other ones. We don't really need to deep dive into it because we've talked about it before, but... Ultimately, Herzog was charged with 5 counts of murder in 1999. 3 of them he did with Shermantine. And then he was charged for another one of this person, Robert Robin Ray Armtrout. He ended up being found guilty of murder for a couple of the previous ones with Shermantine and to be an accessory of murder for another one. He was acquitted in the Armtrout case, but ended up being sentenced to 75 or 78 years for the other crimes. Then in 2004, all of Herzog's convictions were overturned in appeals court as it was ruled that his confessions were coerced.
Ugh.
And there was even like a retrial ordered for one of the cases, but it didn't happen. And a plea bargain was reached. Herzog pleaded guilty to voluntary manslaughter and furnishing amphetamine in the Vanderheiden case. He also admitted to being an accessory to murder in the cases of the other 3. So basically this whole time, the 2 of them were saying the other one did it, which is just fucking ridiculous. So after this, his sentence was reduced to 14 years with some credit. He ends up only being set to serve 11 years. He's paroled in 2010. And I don't know if you guys remember this part, but the public was furious about this.
Yeah.
And they were like, he cannot be in our community. We are not going to have that.
Yes.
So he was paroled to live in this trailer that was outside the front gates of the High Desert Prison.
Right. And we had a listener write in about that, right? And to a listener short stack, we had a listener write in that lived in the area.
Yes. So then in 2012, a bounty hunter tells Herzog that Shermantine is going to tell authorities where some of the victims' bodies are. So Herzog hangs himself in his trailer in 2012. So it's this whole thing. Shermantine ends up being offered money and draws a map to where a lot of their bodies were, which is this well in a farm in Linden, California, where they find over 1,000 bone fragments. And, like, new victims they didn't even know about were in there. So that's the Speed Freak Killers in a nutshell. They are suspected to have possibly murdered up to 72 people in San Joaquin County, California. So a lot of people think that Lauren is Lauren Herzog. He does match the physical description somewhat. Like, he has this pointy nose.
Receding hairline.
His hair was more dirty blonde than red, but I could see how you would maybe think that. Bulging, watery eyes. He's a meth addict.
Yep.
I don't know. It does kind of add up. And they were operating in the general area where the women were last seen alive. So one Sitcoms Online user did point out that there's like a very direct line from Stockton where they were operating around to I-5. And at the time that Marie and Maria were found, the Speed Freak Killers, after this, started dumping bodies in the well on a rural property. So they were like, these bodies were found by hunters, and they needed to find a new location that wasn't going to be just stumbled upon by people.
That tracks. Well, and not only for the hunters that found them, they whoever it was tried to hide it, but the animals dragged it out. So they also need a place where animals are not going to be messing with the bodies. Because maybe the hunter wouldn't have found it if that arm hadn't been seen out of the brush, which is horrible. But
So I don't know. There's not a ton other than those couple things that add up, though. So, like I said, the physical description doesn't match completely. They were definitely operating in the same area. But other than that, there's not much else. And the fact that UM at one point said they had identified this Lauren and then promptly a few years later taken all mentions of his name out makes me think that whoever this Lauren was, whether it was Herzog or not, was eliminated as a suspect. Because they did say, I think in the original update, that they had gone to his apartment and found some evidence that could have been incriminating and all this stuff. So they definitely looked into this person and then chose to remove him from the update.
But they never say it was Lauren Herzog.
They don't.
Yeah. Just a Lauren. Lauren isn't a very common name for a man, though.
That's what I thought, too.
It's not Bob or Bill. Do they spell it L-O-R-E-N when you're a man? Yeah, L-O-R-E-N.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, there's some other stuff. Like, Lauren Herzog definitely wasn't from Canada.
Yeah.
I think his vehicle was slightly different than this one the guy described with the green canoe. Other stuff. So, I don't know. There's not a lot to go on. It just, it would add up, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
There was also a couple people on the message boards that thought that GSK could have done it. I don't think that's true because it just, not the MO.
It doesn't fit his MO at all.
Yeah.
At all.
Right area, right time, but other than that, doesn't really matter.
No, he was busy breaking into people's homes.
Yeah, you needed to be in a home and he needed to be able to put teacups on your partner's back.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
He had a lot of things on his checklist he was doing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's not solved. And
wow, bummer.
You know, and I listened to a little bit of Robin Warder's episode and he kind of agreed that, like, it's probably not Lauren Herzog. Maybe it was a person named Lauren, but I don't know.
Huh.
Yeah. So, and it's possible because this person didn't even say this guy admitted to killing them. He just said he hated women and that he had mentioned that these Swedish hitchhikers were conning him. So he's like, maybe this person who called it in just like really jumped to conclusions and thought, well, he must have murdered them then, you know, so I don't know. We don't know. And unfortunately, it's just a very common thing to see as young women murdered when hitchhiking.
Yeah.
So sad. So sad.
Yeah.
Because, yes, it's not a safe thing to do, but they had run into a few people that were trying to keep them safe. So it's like if they had just not been in the place where this one evil person was, they would have been fine.
Yeah.
Sad.
These men are picking them up and telling them, hey, it's really dangerous. Everyone that they're speaking to is telling them to stop doing this, telling them how dangerous it is. And they just thought that it was going to be fine.
Yeah. Their American friends, their Swedish friends, their parents, the other truck drivers, everyone's like, please
like,
don't do
how many more people do you need to say that this is really, really dangerous?
You just never believe it will happen to you.
Truly.
Yeah. And the dad even said, like, she had told me about how many times she had done it and it would have been totally fine. And they took pictures with these guys that were so great.
And that's what I mean. It just takes one. And then you don't get to speak about it anymore. Because
That's really sad.
My name's Brian Stratton.
And I'm Rob Milne.
And we co-host Marvel by the Month, a podcast that takes you through the history of Marvel Comics one month at a time. From August 1961 to whenever they decide to stop making these things.
It's like the best book club in the world, hosted by guys who thought they knew a lot more about this stuff before they started this podcast.
Look for Marvel by the Month wherever you get your podcasts or at marvelbythemonth.com.
So, this is the story of Joe Soule. So Stack begins by telling us about Georgia Tan, who Eliza covered in season 2, episode 11. And we learned all about Georgia Tan's illegal black market baby ring and what a monster she was.
Horrible.
Stack says, thanks to UM viewers, more than 200 children placed for adoption by Georgia Tan have been reunited with their families, which is amazing.
Truly incredible.
200.
Truly incredible.
200. So Stack says that such happy endings are certainly gratifying, but the appalling fact remains that Georgia Tan was not the only one of her kind. Another notorious baby broker was Bessie Bernard, who bought and sold thousands of children. One of them would learn of his adoption in a very painful way. His story begins almost 50 years ago in Nyack, New York. In 1944, Joe Soule was in his first months of kindergarten. And there's a reenactment, and it's very, like, Christmas story vibes. So there's a reenactment of children playing ball in front of a school. And one little boy tells another little boy, you're an adopted kid.
Oh, so stupid.
And also, we've seen, like, three reenactments like this.
I know. Kids.
With these dick bitch children.
Well, and, like, okay, dick bitch children, parents. Absolutely. But what about the parents?
Yes. Yeah.
That entrust their dumb, shitty five-year-old with this very closely held information.
Yeah, it's not okay.
So that their rotten brat can go ruin some other child's life. I hate it. First of all, fuck this kid. But first of all, even more, what about the parents?
Yes.
Like, garbage.
So Joe is interviewed, and he says that he didn't know what adopted meant, but he knew it was bad because of the way the kids said it. Mm. Joe says he ran home crying, and he asked his mother what that meant, and was he adopted? His mother said yes, and told him that his, quote, real parents, we say biological, not real, and we say adoptive, not fake.
Yeah.
So she told him, yes, that his real parents were killed in a car crash, but that he's safe now, and now they're his real parents. And she says that they love him so much. And that's a lot for a five-year-old to hear after a bad day at school, I have to say. Poor little thing, five years old. So Joe had been adopted in 1939 by Florence and Charles Soule. Charles was a successful attorney who died unexpectedly in 1960. It wasn't until 20 years later that Joe learned that his birth parents had not died in a car accident after all, a fact which his mother reluctantly confirmed. Joe says that his mother told him that his father had handled the whole thing, and that she really didn't want to know, and that he didn't want to tell her. Charles just told her that he fixed it so that nobody could ever find out anything, which Joe says is very scary for him. Stack says that after extensive maneuvering, Joe gained access to his father's records. Filled with anticipation, he began the search for his origins. Joe found a file that his father had left with all of the letters that Charles had written looking for a baby. Joe learned that his name was Robert Wilson when he was born, and that his birthday was November 3rd, 1939, and that his mother's name was Ruth Haverman. And there was an adoption decree. So there's a reenactment of Joe asking a man outside a building if the address was 677 Lexington Avenue. Joe says that he knew that his birth mother was supposed to have lived at that address in New York City. But Joe says that there was never a Haverman at 677 Lexington Ave. He says that he knows there was a family named Haversack that lived at that address, and that the address was a home for unwed mothers. Mm. Disheartened, Joe went back to the old files. He discovered that his father had corresponded regularly with an adoption agent named Bessie Bernard. Stack says that in the New York City archives, Joe found out more about Bessie Bernard than he had ever bargained for. Joe came across New York Times articles from 1949 when she was arrested for baby selling. Joe realized that he was a black market baby and that he was sold, and then his mother confirmed it. Joe says that it was very painful. He felt like a piece of property. He says, it's a strange feeling to know that someone paid money for you. And at this point, as I'm watching it, I'm thinking to myself, oh, he kind of reminds me of my father-in-law. But I was watching it at double speed. So I thought, well, he reminds me of my father-in-law, but he's talking too quickly. And then I turned off the double speed and I was horrified. Because he's exactly like my father-in-law.
Yes.
He has the exact same tone, the exact same mannerisms, the exact same, like, the way he speaks, the things he says. It is truly like my father-in-law.
That is so, because when I was watching him, I thought, he reminds me of someone. He has very specific mannerisms and a way he talks, and I couldn't place who it was.
Oh my gosh.
I don't remember well enough. I'll have to go back and watch again.
My father-in-law.
Weird. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. So Stack says that Bessie Bernard lived with her father in Manhattan. She used newspaper ads to round up infants for her thriving baby adoption brokerage. The reenactment is amazing, and the Bessie reenactor is the best. She says, quote, we're making lots of dough. It's good.
Oh, my God. It's good.
It's good. We're making lots of dough. It's
just
good.
Just living life with her father. Weird.
Oh. So Stack says Bessie Bernard charged each adoptive couple up to $2,000, a huge sum at the time.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. What is $2,000 equal to
in
1939? What is it equal to today? Just take a guess.
Oh, my God. Wait, what year was it?
1939.
$15,000.
Okay, what's your guess, Carlin?
I don't know.
$40,000.
No. Oh, my God.
And Joe says that she averaged 20 adoptions a month.
Oh, my God.
Are you flipping kidding me?
Honestly, I would do this too.
I know.
Say that.
That I wouldn't. I would never, but that is horrible.
Well, I was just appalled that someone else besides Georgia Tan was doing this. But
although
now,
this one's not stealing. This one's not as bad.
No, she's not stealing.
She's taking kids that maybe the parents didn't want them or the moms couldn't keep them.
Well, yeah, we'll get into it a little bit. I do have to say that when I was doing this research, there are probably about 10 adoption agents who are famous for either selling babies or stealing babies and then selling them. Yeah. So there were a lot more than Georgia Tan. Wow.
And this is what happens when there's no social system set up for adoptions.
Yeah.
So they're starting a black market because they can.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I hated also the term baby brokerage.
Yeah, oh, I cannot believe
black market baby brokerage.
Baby broker. Ugh. Oh, man.
So Joe says that she brought them in from Florida, Hartford, Connecticut, Boston, anywhere she could get babies, she advertised. Mm. He says she brought them in, had their births registered in New York, and changed their names. Joe says that what she did was vicious. Mm. Stack says that by 1949, the Manhattan District Attorney was on to Bessie Bernard. On October 8, 1949, two police officers with a search warrant showed up at her apartment. When the detectives started to rummage through Bernard's purse, she went, quote, berserk. In the reenactment, she fights with the officer, and she grabs this little black book out of his hand and tosses it to her father.
Honey. What a team.
I know. Her father then runs out the front door. And it's believed that the book contained information about her clients and the children that they had bought. But Bessie's father escaped, and the book was never recovered. So this little old man ran out. And then I think a detective started chasing him, but then Bessie was, like, attacking the other detective. So the guy had to come back and help the detective with Bessie.
Weird.
So the dad got away and destroyed the book. Or hid the book. And then they never found it. Yeah.
Flushed it down a toilet.
Totally.
And was he never found?
The dad was found, but the book was never
found. The book was
found.
Not. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So, let's see. On June 30th, 1950, Bessie Bernard was found guilty of illegally placing children up for adoption. The judge gave her 1 year. And then Stack says that Bessie Bernard never spent a day in jail. She paid a $2,500 fine to avoid serving her one-year sentence.
No.
It's almost like the justice system is different for rich people. I don't get it.
Gosh, you know.
It is almost like that.
Between Bessie Bernard and Dick Minns, it seems like it might be.
Mm. Fucking Dick Minns.
I know, right? Don't you hate them with the fire of a thousand suns? Because I do. Yeah. Bessie Bernard died in 1989, taking her secrets with her. Joe says that what makes him angry and fills him with pain is because Bernard always change the names and dates and locations that he and so many other people can't find their families. Mm-hmm. Joe says that he understands how much his parents wanted a baby and why they did what they did, but he needs to find his family. He says that he could have a mother, a brother, a sister, cousins, aunts, uncles, and he needs to know who his family is. Stack says that Joe Soul thinks that his mother's name was either Ruth Haverman or Ruth Haversack. She may have had a friend named Lucy Bent. Joe's father is listed as Robert Wilson, an engineer who worked in Hartford, Connecticut. Joe Soul believes that he was born in Manhattan on November 3rd, 1939, or 1 week earlier in Florida, which is a big diff.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and then there's an update. It says that through Ancestry.com, Joe Soul was reunited with several relatives, including two first cousins and a half-brother. Sadly, he learned that his birth mother had passed away. And that's the update. So I have some more information for you.
Oh, my gosh. What a turn of the century time to, like.
Yes.
Like, he's old enough that he was a black market baby.
Yeah.
But he found his relatives via Ancestry.com.
Absolutely.
What?
That's true. Yeah.
It's crazy. So Joe Soul is very easy to find. He's a psychotherapist, an advocate for adoptees and, quote, first mothers. Oh. He writes self-help books, and he's a motivational speaker.
Love.
He is active on Facebook. And from the comments on his page and the reviews of his books, he's helped a lot of people in the last 30 plus years. I found a post that he wrote that elaborated on him finding his family on Ancestry.com. So the post says, as a child, I had been told my mother died in a car crash after I was born. In 1982, I found out that my mother was not killed in a car crash, and my search began. I soon found out that I was sold by a famous baby seller, Bessie Bernard. And I read that one day in 1982, his adoption came up in conversation with his sister, who told him for the first time that the story of an automobile accident was a lie. He didn't start looking for his mother until his early 40s. So he didn't know until he was in his 40s that it was a lie. Joe writes, I found several women who could have been my mother, but none were, and I kept hitting brick walls. In 1987, I sued the state of New York based on my being sold. It took 2 years, but my attorney, an adoptee friend of mine, won my case on appeal.
Wow.
So this is how, when Stack says after a lot of maneuvering in the segment, he was able to look at his dad's letters. This is how. He had to sue the state.
Wow.
Uh-huh. He says, I got my original birth certificate, and eventually the New York City Health Department acknowledged that the information on my original birth certificate was fiction. There was no birth log for me that matched my original birth certificate. My mother's name and my birth date and place were all fiction. So he has no information. He says, I hired the best searchers I knew of, the ones who could do magic tricks, but to no avail. Over the years, I sent DNA swabs to several DNA companies, not for searching, as it never occurred to me that I could ever find anyone that way or be found that way, but to get information on my heritage. The most concrete information I could get from any of them was that my mother was part Asian and that I was not Jewish. I never gave up in my heart, but there's nothing more I could do search-wise than pray. Early last year, on a whim, I bought a St. Jude, the Saint of Lost Causes, medal, and I hung it around my neck. I forgot about it. A few months later, I signed up with Ancestry.com to try once again to find additional heritage information. I was truly shocked when it came up with a match for two cousins, Karen and Mel. It happens that Mel's favorite aunt was named Ruth. She was the right age and living in New York when I was born. She lived a few miles across the river from me for most of my life until she died in 1987. My original birth certificate says my mother's first name was Ruth, but that the last name was slightly different than Mel's aunt Ruth. And that's the kind of thing that Bessie Bernard, who sold me, did with the sold babies. So Ruth's last name was Braverman. And if you remember, on the birth certificate, it says Haverman. When Mel and I spoke, it was clear that Ruth had to be my mother. Mel drove hours to see me, and we had dinner on a Saturday evening and breakfast on a Sunday morning. I've also spoken to cousins Karen and Linda and connected to even more via Facebook. Spending time with someone I am related to for the first time in my life was joyous. Hearing stories about my mother and grandmother and others was exciting beyond belief. I have no doubt that my mother has been watching over me and that her doing so has helped me survive the trauma of losing her. I am very sad about her not being here and will go to her graveside to visit her as soon as I can. I am on cloud nine and I feel connected to the earth in a way I never imagined possible. And then I found a post written by Mel about his journey with Ancestry.com. And it's long, so I'm just pulling out some of the quotes about Joe, but I'll link to the full post in the show notes. So in 2015, so this is just 2015, it's not that long ago. Mel wrote, when Karen and I got our DNA results back, we each showed up on the other's results as a first or second cousin with a 99% probability. We had scientific confirmation of what we had concluded from our research. So they found each other through their own ancestral research, these two cousins. And then it was verified by Ancestry.com. And the post is about everybody finding each other. But we each had exactly one other person showing up in the same category. First or second cousin with a 99% probability. That was Joe Soule, the man who at 74 had all but given up after a 30-year effort to learn about his natural mother. Using the few details that Joe was able to provide, Karen and I came up with the most likely candidate who could have been Joe's mother. Ruthie was my first cousin, although she was old enough to be my mother. For reasons that would make this sermon, he's a Unitarian pastor. Far too long to enumerate, she and I had a deep bond, and I loved her like a big sister. 1939, when Joe was born, Ruthie was 22 or 23, unmarried and living with her mother and little sister in a crowded apartment in Queens, New York, in the closing years of the Great Depression. Ruthie would get married about 5 years later, and she and her husband had one son, Bobby, who was profoundly mentally ill. But I remember one conversation with her that left me with the impression that there might have been another child in her past. Ruthie died in 1987 at the age of 70. 6 weeks ago, I took a long weekend in New York State to meet Joe and spend time with him and to visit Bobby at the Rockland Psychiatric Center. By a glorious stroke of luck, I was there to celebrate with Joe when he got final confirmation that Ruthie was indeed his mother. And I realized the bittersweet truth that there is no one living who knows more about Ruthie than I do, so I could tell him about the wonderful person I knew his mother to be. After 30 years of frustration and after helping thousands of others, Joe finally learned about his mother and for the first time met some blood relatives. He has been ecstatic ever since, and every night sends a goodnight email to his newfound cousins. I know, it's so nice. I have like goosebumps. Joe and I have found many parallels in our lives, as though we are long-lost brothers. I am almost as ecstatic as he is. I knew that Joe wanted an artifact from his mother, something that was hers, something that she had touched. Those closest to Ruth, who might have had something of hers, are no longer among the living. I am not a saver. I don't like keeping stuff. But my mother was a saver, and when she died in 1990, most of her things went to my sister, who was also a saver. So in 2010, I inherited a box of stuff that belonged to me. When I returned from my weekend with Joe, I went looking in that box. I found the gift card that Ruthie gave me on my bar mitzvah on May 2nd, 1959. I was able to give Joe something that his mother had held and signed almost 55 years ago.
Oh, so nice.
Yeah, that's like that one, I don't even remember which one it was, but like seeing their mom's actual signature on the papers
was
just like the most important thing to them.
It's like you knew she had touched it.
Yeah.
Since 1989, Joe has organized and coordinated 10 international mental health conferences on adoption. He has been an expert witness in court about adoption-related issues and has lectured at adoption agencies, social work schools, and mental health facilities and mental health conferences in the U.S. and Canada.
Wow.
And 3 times he walked from New York to Washington to support Open Adoption Records.
Wow.
Found some articles about Bessie Bernard's conviction. So she was convicted with 2 other men, one man named Harry Wolfson and another man named Irwin Slater. The article talks about how her father ran out the door with the black book.
I cannot deal with that.
And absolutely, like, makes fun of the detectives for letting it happen. And then this is what the judge, so Judge Francis T. Levente, described the acts of Bessie Bernard as a nauseating and revolting practice of trading in human flesh.
Oh, my yikes.
However, he told Mrs. Bernard that if she paid her fines by November 17th, he would suspend execution of the prison term in her case, saying in her case only, the 2 men went to prison, saying in part, quote, "I am satisfied that in the end you were motivated by conditions of ego satisfaction and a strong desire for social status and acceptance, which motivated your activities. Your urge to be accepted as a benefactress was so strong that I believe it helped to blunt your ethical discrimination and moral concepts." So he's basically like, you wanted to be a fancy rich lady, you couldn't help it, so I'm not going to make you go to jail. I hope you learned your lesson. And then the last thing, and I couldn't find anything more about this, I read that she continued to run adoption rings under her birth name, Elizabeth Wiener, until 1970 in Florida. So Joe had said that she was getting babies from Connecticut, Boston, and Florida, but that was before everybody knew that she was changing all of the information.
The records, yeah.
The records. So she actually was only getting the babies from Florida. So they would put the advertisements in, like, the Miami Herald, like, in the major cities in Florida. Then they would bring the babies up from Florida. But she was charging $2,000 a baby, and she was paying the mothers that she was taking the babies from $50 to $150.
Oh, my God.
And then selling these babies at, like, an insane profit. Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, and then I wanted to learn more about what she did later, but the name Elizabeth Wiener is shockingly common.
unfortunately.
So I wasn't able to find her. But yeah, like I said, her and Georgia Tan, I mean, there were a ton of these baby brokers making so much money, either stealing children or having their mothers sign away rights under duress or paying them a paltry sum for their kid. I mean, yeah,
it's so horrible.
It's so horrible. Yeah.
And the fucking Black Book. Probably I know. Probably could have helped someone else find their family. Yes.
It would have helped pretty much every person that had adopted through her, because they think that all of the information about the birth parents, the adoptive parents, and the child were in that book.
Ugh.
So basically, if they would have gotten their hands on that book, they would have been able to track a ton of children.
That is awful.
But her spry daddy.
Oh, my God.
Spry daddy just ran out the door.
Truly.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the story of Joe Soul, who is very much, he's in his, I think, mid to late 80s now.
Wow.
Posts all the time on Facebook inspirational quotes.
Oh.
You can have him come and lecture at your school. He's on a website where you can book him to lecture, and he's still going. Mm-hmm.
All right, that was part one of season 4, episode 21. Come back next week for part 2. I have an unexplained death segment about Gary Simmons.
And I have a fuck.
Fraud Richard Condia.
I have a fraud segment about Richard Condia.
And we love you, and we'll see you then.
We love you so.
We won't see you.
Oh, you're right.
Well, you'll hear us.
We're going to talk to you.
Goodbye.
Part 2. Goodbye.
Are you glad I did that?
Yeah, you crushed it. Go to patreon.com/resolvedmysteriespodcast if you're interested in supporting us there. If you subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher, you're going to get ad-free episodes, 2 extra episodes a month, and other goodies in the mail. To see photos we reference in the episode, follow us on Instagram at Resolve Mysteries Podcast and on Facebook and Twitter at Resolve the Pod. You can contact us at resolvemysteriespodcast.com, resolvemysteriespodcast@gmail.com, or at our P.O. Box, 14005, Portland, Oregon, 97293. Send us your stories for listener short stack episodes. If you want to email us your favorite unsolved mystery story or cold case or any nostalgia you have surrounding the show, send it our way because we love to hear from you. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like us, leave a 5-star review and tell a friend or tell 2 or tell 3. Don't forget, for every review we receive, we donate $1 to a different nonprofit.
Recording.
Okay. Do you want to do the outro?
Yes.
Okay. One. Oh. Two. God.
I was going to count, but you got it.
No, you do it.
No, you do it. Okay.
I'll do it.
Okay. You do it, Kyla.
One, two, three.
Oy, oy, oy.